apology. One from Mukhalapa on behalf, I mean from the DA. Honorable Mukhalapa has an apology written. Honorable Dudley from ACTP. Honorable Gowa from the ANC. The permanent apology from Honorable Olumisa. From Bantu, from the what do I forget to call it? Name of community, name of the party.
UTM.
Now you're
not. No, I can't. Honorable Coronel, correct Coronel from the ANC. What are the apologies we have? I don't see it written. And I was informed that you are not going to check. You are supposed to be an apology. You have to check so that you record it properly. Thank you. It's moved by Honorable Manana, seconded by Honorable Mahau, that we accept the apology. We have just two items. The first one is going to be adoption of the set of minutes. Now there are six. And I can tell you one. Sometimes we turn our meetings into workshops. When people say, no, we'll just be here for the first hour, then we're going into other meetings. This suggests then we might be forced. The reason why we're picked up Friday is that we know that a lot of people are free from the committee. But there's this tendency of making Friday a weekend, whereas it's a working day. I'm going to be very hard on that. I know of committees which are meeting over weekends, when people are behind. So as this committee, you must be ready that we're going to do. I'll be speaking to the whips of the different parties that we will have to consider. So the second item will be, the first item will be adoption of those minutes. The second one will be just a briefing on the treaty making processes in South Africa. Remember, we've been talking about international treaties. So the second part of it will be more of a workshop line. But the first one, that's where we must just adopt the minutes. I have, and these minutes I remember very well, in the last meeting, we had to ensure that every member has them, including those who are not here. The first set, is there any correction on the minutes? The 17th set? Any correction? Seeing that there are no corrections, moved by Honorable Mahau and seconded by Honorable Mohu. No objection. So we move. Can we go into the second set, which is the 3rd of March? Any corrections? They were given 2 weeks ago. No corrections, moved by Honorable Mugu, seconded by Honorable Manan. 17th March, moved by Honorable Manan, seconded by Honorable Mahau. Moved. Honorable Honorable Manana is seconding. Are you ready to second? Any objections? None. Adopted. 20th April. Seconded by Honorable Manan. Any objection? None. Adopted. In my interaction with the authorities who are dealing with the necessary approval, it seems as if we're still on course.
So we can
diarize that? Yes, try and diarize that. And accept that this parliament can disappoint you at the last moment, but you must diarize that. Move. We're going to Zimbabwe.
Wow. Yeah, you're going
with us. Good luck.
We are in Zimbabwe. Yeah, you must include us. We are here to help you.
It's moved by Honorable Mugu and seconded by Honorable Maha. Any objections? None is adopted. Not going to deal with any matters arising. In fact, all I can tell you is what Honorable Mugu has raised is in the pipeline, and our Limpopo is in the pipeline. What are the possible dates, by the way? It's a week after this one. Now we'll deliver this coming case. We'll step off that particular item. Then we go in the workshop mode. Let me also welcome a lot of researchers from the different organizations who have an interest in this particular topic, because it's a very interesting one. And then we will hand over to, do you want to, yes. I will excuse you, because you've done the formal part. We are now in the workshop part. Salim, I'm trying to pronounce this very well. He's Salim Nakhavan. He's with UCT. The School of International Law, the Department of Public Law. We had requested him to come and make a presentation together with the department on the treaty making process in South Africa. The role of Parliament in particular. You remember that this becomes like at the level of the executive. And he's going to present for 30 minutes, Honorable Mugu and Honorable Manana. 30 minutes. Then if we have questions, you can raise questions. And the researchers there from the different institutions, you also can interact with this process. It's going to be a very important process. So, and I know that our researchers here, Dineo and Numpo, have an interest in this particular matter.
But the department has sent us a letter to say the only people available are junior people. They are senior state law advisors are outside because of a number of arguments they have to deal with. They wanted to send those. I said, no. We want people who are going to answer everything. Hence, we have had to have one presentation, which therefore says, in the next session, we might have to take that particular presentation. Can we hand over to you, sir, Salim? You have 30 minutes.
I was explaining to the Honourable Chair and the Contents Advisor that my wife has just given birth to twins.
Oh.
These twins are the first South Africans in our family. My wife is also South African. And although I am not South African, I'm only a permanent resident. Now that this country has given me so much, for me it's an honour to be able to give something small and humble back. So it's in this spirit that I appear before you. I was requested to prepare
the Congressman.
So my work colleagues call me Tata Wamawele now. So there we are. I've been asked by the content advisor to prepare a briefing paper for you, looking at the role of treaties in international life, particularly their significance for South Africa, and also to address the prospect for enhancing the role of Parliament in treaty making and implementation. So I'll do that first by providing a little bit of an overview of the role of treaties. I'll look at the international law framework that governs treaties so that we are all familiar with the language and the processes of international law relating to the formation of treaties. Then I will look briefly at the South African constitutional framework, the famous Section 231, and some of the possibilities there. Then I will look at some comparative examples of parliaments, mostly Westminster-style parliaments, from other parts of the world, to see the role that they are playing in treaty making and implementation in a way that respects fully the rights and prerogatives of the executive, but also allows for enhanced participation by the representatives of the people in concluding these important international agreements. From those comparative examples, we can draw some possibilities of what Parliament in South Africa could do if it wished to do so. My paper makes no recommendation. It only spells out options because it's really for this committee to decide what it wishes to do. It's not for me to say what you should do. So with that, I'll refer to some parts of my paper on the screen and some other documents if we need. But you have the paper in front of you as well, and I'll speak to that. I'm not sure if the visitors also have the paper. We do. Okay. If there are any questions at any point, please don't hesitate to ask. In sum, then, treaties are international agreements that are written down, and they are governed by international law. Informal agreements, oral agreements, are not treaties. They must be written, they must be governed by international law. Political agreements between states are not usually treaties. There must be an intention to create legal obligations. You can think of a treaty in some ways as a contract between two countries, between many countries, or between a country and an international organization. Sometimes between two international organizations. We often hear that international law is a customary legal system. It's based on customary practices. But those customary practices are supplemented by a huge volume of treaties. which lay down written rules in every area of international life, from the environment to crime control to human rights to many, many other areas that I could mention. For this reason, scholars refer to treaties as the workhorse of international law. They refer to it as an indispensable tool of diplomacy and the most important instrument for regulating international affairs. Since the establishment of the United Nations, I point out in the paper, some 54,000 treaties have been registered with the United Nations. Why was there such an explosion in the number of treaties from 1945? There are a number of reasons. The first is that there is an awareness in the world that certain problems are too complex for one country to deal with alone. There is a need for concerted international action. So the model of the world that sees states as having unfettered, unrestrained sovereignty, sitting alone, doing their own thing, that model no longer suits the need of our time. Problems like climate change, like transnational criminal activity, for example, like human security, require cooperation among nations. Treaties are a tool for achieving that cooperation. Treaties also offer states certainty, predictability, and perhaps more fairness in their international relations than the existing customary rules of international law, which are unwritten and fluid. Treaties allow powerful and weaker states to write down the rules. Now, of course, it's a challenge for weaker states to make sure that those rules are fair and that those rules are sufficiently precise to protect their rights. Sometimes in treaty negotiations, states have an interest in keeping the rules vague. That's something to bear in mind. Now, why should the South African Parliament care about treaty making? South Africa's treaty practice is a significant part of its international relations practice. According to publicly available information from the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, I've been able to find that South Africa has, since 1994, ratified or acceded to some 261 multilateral treaties and 1,694 bilateral treaties, treaties between South Africa and one other country. So we can see that they are a significant part of South Africa's international presence. When you examine these treaties, and we can look at the list if you wish, you see that increasingly, treaties in the area of crime control, human rights, and trade especially, affect the day-to-day lives of people in South Africa because they require the state to give certain rights or to criminalize certain conduct, for example, to adopt rules which are standard across many countries, rules that may be different from the rules that South Africa had for itself. These things affect people's day-to-day lives, the way that they conduct business. What can they trade? What can they export or import? So treaty making and implementation should matter to the legislative authority. We will talk a little bit later about the division of responsibilities between the executive and the legislature. But for the reason of the impact on people, the representatives of the people should care about treaty making. Now, what I'm going to set out in the paper is the international law rules governing treaties, what the Constitution says about the role of Parliament and the role of the executive, and then I will make a suggestion, and it's one that can be accepted or rejected, that the Constitution leaves room to Parliament to do more than it's doing now. Parliament wouldn't be going beyond the bounds of the Constitution to do more in the field of treaty making and implementation than it does now. We'll look at some examples of how it could do so. But first, let me turn to some basic international law definitions. The rules governing treaties in international law tend to be found in a document called the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. It's itself a treaty, So the rules on treaties are found in a treaty. Now, interestingly, South Africa is one of the few countries in the world that has not ratified the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. For me, this was strange. I didn't know why. I assume that this convention, this treaty, because it was opened for signature in 1969 and entered into force in 1980, perhaps the apartheid government didn't care so much to ratify this treaty, and somehow Durko hasn't caught up and done it yet. I don't know. It doesn't really matter that South Africa hasn't ratified this treaty, because its rules largely reflect customary international law anyway, and are binding on South Africa anyway. The International Court of Justice, which is the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, has said that most of the rules in the Vienna Convention are also rules of customary international law, and they bind all states anyway. The Vienna Convention contains rules telling us how treaties are formed, how they should be interpreted, how they can be modified, how they can be terminated. What happens if they are terminated wrongfully? Now, an important point. When we look at Durko's list of multilateral and bilateral treaties, we see that they have many different titles. Let me bring some up here for you to see. Let's look first at the multilateral treaty. This, if I can open a small parenthesis, the content advisor had asked me to address the question of how accessible is this information about which treaty South Africa has ratified to the general public. I'm a member of the general public. I have the privilege to have access to the internet. With that, I was able, in a few minutes, to get a list of all of South Africa's treaties that have been ratified, both bilateral and multilateral, from the website of Durko. However, I was not able to find out the content of these treaties, only the list, the names. When were they signed? When did they enter into force? I don't know what is in there, what legal obligation South Africa has under these treaties. So that's the point perhaps that the committee may want to consider going forward, is how to enhance the availability of the information to the general public, to South Africa. You can see here that most of these treaties are called convention on, convention concerning. Some are called agreement. Some are called protocol. Some are called statute. These are some of the names that are used. Other names are compact, charter, joint communique, many other names. Memorandum of understanding is sometimes used as well. It's important to bear in mind that the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties applies to all treaties regardless of their name. As long as there is a written agreement governed by international law, which is based on an intent to create legal obligations, not only to make a political statement, the Vienna Convention will apply to that treaty. You can call it whatever you want. I should mention at this stage some of the challenges with the word memorandum of understanding. Durko has registered 16 memoranda of understanding as multilateral treaties and 226 memoranda of understanding as bilateral treaties. Diplomats use the word memorandum of understanding in several ways. Sometimes when they say memorandum of understanding, they mean a non-binding statement, a non-legal agreement. But in this case, the 16 and the 226, obviously Durko sees these as treaties that create legal obligations. They're still called memorandum of understanding. What that shows us is that we must look at the content of these documents to decide if they are treaties or not. The name doesn't tell us. Now, I want to briefly outline the process whereby treaties come into force. We usually begin with a negotiation, and this happens typically behind closed doors. As an outsider, as someone who is not on the delegation, I can't really tell you what happens in this negotiation. There is some trading of interests, perhaps, but that's usually a secret process. The authentic text of the treaty is adopted, and it's open for signature. And then there is a process called ratification, or accession, and finally the treaty enters into force. So let us look now at... a question? Chip.
Chip, did you say we can ask questions in between or at the end?
Please, I would welcome your question.
No, just to clarify on what he's saying. When you say a treaty is something that is signed to so that all the signatures, all the countries that signed, observe the content of that agreement or treaty. Now, why do you then say when you negotiate, you can change things here and there and certain interests? And because if a treaty is supposed to, all of us sign it, we all have to observe every. Why do we have to negotiate differently? For example, if it's another country and I'm another country, I negotiate with you on that to sign that treaty. Why do I have to sign to negotiate differently from her or from anybody else? That's what I want to understand. Because I think those negotiations sometimes are designed to protect maybe national interests.
Yes.
Sure. So, about the other international national interests of other countries. So, are they going to be at the end? That treaty is not going to be a uniform treaty. It's going to be different for every other country.
So, if I could answer through the chair the question of the honourable member. Negotiation happens before the final text of the treaty is agreed. So negotiation is the process whereby states agree what should actually be the content of the treaty, what should be the obligation that it sets down. Only then is it signed and ratified. So the final agreement will be uniform. But the reason I said what I said is to point out that in treaty negotiations, before states have agreed what is the content, there is a lot of what you could call horse trading. And certainly, the voices of some countries are heard more loudly than others in the treaty negotiations. We know that South Africa played a significant role in the climate change negotiations, which perhaps Angola or Botswana didn't. Why? South Africa is a regional leader. Very simple. There is this, as they say, realpolitik. Now, it's important to note that signature doesn't usually mean that a state is bound by the treaty. Usually, states will sign treaties subject to ratification. That's an important thing. It's possible for a treaty to become binding on signature if it says so. But usually, the international practice and the practice of South Africa is to say we sign now, but we are not yet bound until we ratify. Ratification is the process whereby a state tells other states, we are now bound by this treaty. We accept the obligation. Why is there this distinction? When you and I enter a contract, we sign, it's finished, we're bound. Why is there this delay? The reason is that most treaties require some adjustment in the domestic legal system before they can come into force. That needs time. So states say, we accept the principles of this treaty, we sign it. Now we will take it back to our parliament, we must adopt implementing legislation, we have to assess our readiness to comply with this treaty, we must train our staff, we must do various other, we must have a public education program. Now we are ready to ratify. We now present to the Secretary General of the UN or to the other party a document saying we are now bound. This is our instrument of ratification. Now, a question that often comes up is, does ratification mean that South Africa is giving up its sovereignty? My answer to that would be no. Ratification expresses a state's consent to be bound by the treaty. That consent is an exercise of sovereignty, not a sacrifice of sovereignty. That's one way to see it. Now, you will often hear this word accession when you talk about treaties. Sometimes ratification, sometimes accession. What does this mean? Most of South Africa's treaties that were written before 1994, South Africa has acceded to them, not ratified them. This is a small technical difference. The difference is this. When a treaty is open for signature, usually it's open for signature for a fixed period of time. They say, for 2 years, countries may sign. After that, the book is closed. You can't sign anymore. Accession is a process whereby a state that has not signed the treaty can become bound by it anyway. for some older treaties that the apartheid government didn't sign, South Africa has to accede because the period for signature is closed. It's not possible to sign and ratify, only to accede. But in practice, this makes very little difference. South Africa is still bound by the treaty. It has the same obligations. It's just that it hasn't gone through this process of signature and then, a few years later, ratification. It's just acceded. It's accepted those obligations. Now, it's important to bear in mind that a country like South Africa has certain obligations when it signs. It has other obligations when a treaty has been ratified. When a treaty has been signed, South Africa's only obligation is not to defeat the object and purpose of that treaty. It has none of the other specific obligations in the treaty, only this general obligation, not to defeat the treaty's object and purpose. Once a treaty has attracted a sufficient number of ratifications, and the treaty itself will say this treaty comes into force when it has got 10 ratifications, or 60 ratifications, or 100 ratifications. Once that number of states have ratified the treaty enters into force. It's only on that date that South Africa is bound by the treaty. In other words, it has legal obligations and duties towards other countries from the date of entry into force. This is why in the list of multinational treaties, for example, you can see that the statutes of the World Tourism Organization were acceded to in 1994. Look below the Convention on the Means of Prohibiting and Preventing the Illicit Import, etc., of Cultural Property. Entry in South Africa acceded in 2003, December 18, but the treaty entered into force 2004, March 18. So there was some delay there. Maybe they were waiting for other states to ratify before that treaty could enter into force. Let me now turn to some quick look at the framework of Section 231 of the Constitution, and here I'm acutely aware that as a non-South African, I don't want to lecture South Africans on the contents of your own Constitution. So, but forgive me, I only make these suggestions with humility. You'll be familiar, honorable members, through the chair, with Section 231 of the Constitution, which lays out the responsibility for treaty making and implementation in the Republic. The key elements are that negotiation and signing fall within the responsibility of the National Executive. It's important to note that in the interim Constitution of 1993, reference was made to negotiation and signing being a responsibility of the President. In the final Constitution, it says the Executive. This is a difference which should not be ignored. There's a difference between the presidency being responsible and the executive being responsible. We should also note that it doesn't say the exclusive responsibility of the executive. It says the responsibility. Now, the general rule in South Africa is that a treaty, in order to be ratified, must be approved by Parliament. It must be presented to Parliament, to both houses of Parliament, for approval. The only treaties that do not need that parliamentary approval are the agreements in Section 231(3), agreements of a technical, administrative, or executive nature, or an agreement which does not require ratification or accession. So, let's look at these two. States often enter agreements that regulate very minor matters, some cooperation, border cooperation in policing, or something to do with a loan agreement, or something very, very minor and technical. That may be an agreement of a technical, administrative, or executive nature. It wouldn't require parliamentary approval. Some treaties also say they will enter into force without ratification. There is no need for ratification because the treaty deals with matters that don't affect the domestic law at all, don't affect the legislation of South Africa at all. So South Africa can agree with other countries, this treaty will enter into force without ratification. If the South African executive agrees that with other countries, the treaty doesn't doesn't have to come for approval in Parliament. It must still be tabled within a reasonable time, however. Section 231(4) causes some difficulties. It's new. It wasn't in the interim constitution. 231(4) says that parts of treaties that are self-executing will be law in the Republic, even if they haven't been transformed into South African law by an act of Parliament. The Constitution doesn't tell us what is a self-executing provision, and the question of what is a self-executing provision has caused tremendous difficulty for the courts in the United States, where their constitution uses similar language. It's going to be very difficult to tell which parts of a treaty are designed, are intended to be directly applicable on the territory of the states that have ratified that treaty without any legislation. It will be for the courts to interpret this question. We don't know. But I will mention later that parliaments in other countries do, if they don't agree that a treaty should be self-executing, they will take action by adopting inconsistent legislation. You see that Section 231(4) says a self-executing provision is law in the Republic unless it is inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. So in countries like the Netherlands, the United States, and many others, if Parliament doesn't want a treaty to be self-executing, Parliament will adopt legislation that is inconsistent with the treaty to block its self-execution. Now, these are the basic provisions of 231. Let's see how it applies in practice. That's the challenge. We don't know what happens in treaty negotiations because the process is usually secret behind closed doors. But a parliamentary official, perhaps you know him, Mr. Ahmad. Yes.
How much time do you have? I mean, how much time do you want to
I can take another 15 minutes. Is that reasonable? Or? Okay. So, what we know about treaty negotiations, we know from what has been made public. One place where it's been made public is in a recent case called Quagliani, which dealt with an extradition treaty between South Africa and the United States. The suggestion was that South Africa's extradition treaties were unlawful because they had not been properly approved by Parliament. That argument was not dealt with. It was raised too late by the lawyers, and the court rejected it for that reason. But in the process of giving the decision, the Constitutional Court outlines the process whereby these treaties were negotiated and implemented. This extradition treaty. What we see is it took 3 years from the initial negotiation to the ratification of the treaty and its approval by Parliament. We see that, importantly, Parliament's role was limited to discussions in the relevant committees and then a simple motion was passed in both houses. That's what Parliament did. The treaty-making process in South Africa is guided by the Manual on Executive Acts of the Office of the President, on the one hand, which I'm sure the honorable members are familiar with, and also by a practical guide and procedures for the conclusion of agreements, which is published by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor for International Law. This is roughly the process. In order for an agreement, a treaty, to be ratified by South Africa, we must go through all of these stages. The state law advisors are asked to advise on the consistency of the treaty with domestic law. The state law advisors are given an opinion on the consistency of the treaty with South Africa's other international obligations. So both sets of legal advice are sought. Then there's a presidential minute that is prepared. the presidential minutes give the approval for the treaty to be signed. An explanatory memorandum is prepared, and then this is the critical question. The line function department, for example, if it's a trade treaty, it will be the Department of Trade, etc., together with the state law advisors for international law, are the ones that say they can decide if an agreement falls under Section 231(2) of the Constitution or 231(3) of the Constitution. In other words, is this an agreement that requires the approval of Parliament, or is it a merely technical administrative agreement that does not require parliamentary approval? According to the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor for International Law, it is the line function department and the law advisor that make that call, that make that decision. This has a significant impact on the role Parliament can play. That is what they claim in their guide to the conclusion of agreement. It is a bureaucrat deciding, and I will happily supply to you the document where they say this, so that you can see for yourself. What they say in their own guidelines is that an agreement will be considered to be technical, administrative, executive, not requiring parliamentary approval if, A, it does not require ratification or accession, that I've already mentioned, B, it has no extra budgetary financial implications. In other words, to approve this treaty requires no new money from Parliament. Three, the treaty does not require legislation or the amendment of legislation. If that's the case, the bureaucrats will say we don't need to ask parliamentary approval. Now, one commentator who is actually a parliamentary official called Mr. Ahmad, he writes in an individual capacity in a scholarly paper. What he says is Parliament's role in the foreign policy decision-making process is virtually absent. Even parliamentary debates between the ruling and opposition parties on matters of foreign policy tend to be limited, with one or two exceptions. So now we must ask ourselves, in the few minutes that remain, what might Parliament be doing? What is the possibility? In 1994, there was a comparative study of some states: Brazil, Argentina, the United States, UK, France, Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, Italy. So not very representative of the world, but it's what we have. A study of their parliaments. How do they participate in treaty making? What we see is that these countries are very different one from the other in their constitutions. Some constitutions say that the executive is the only body that can negotiate treaties. Others say, no, all treaties must be approved by Parliament. So there's big constitutional differences between these countries. But there are some common practices, even though there are such big differences. One of those common practices is that any time a treaty is negotiated in any of those countries that was surveyed in 1994, the executive consults with the leaders of parliament before the negotiations. There is an informal process of consultation. I've mentioned already that in these countries, parliaments do exercise their powers to say this treaty is not going to be self-executing because we are going to adopt inconsistent legislation. Legislation that is inconsistent with the treaty, we don't want it to be self-executing. In some of these parliaments as well, parliament can exercise budgetary pressure on the executive to force the executive to negotiate the treaty in a certain way. And in some of these countries, I'm not saying this is appropriate for South Africa, I'm just saying this is the practice in other countries, the parliament will say, we will not give you money for this purpose unless the treaty says that. So they use their financial powers to limit what the executive does. Now, that's something to bear in mind. I want to also briefly mention the example of Canada, because Canada and South Africa are close in terms of the way the constitution is written and the way the constitution is applied. In Canada, in 2008, the executive decided that it should give Parliament a greater role in the negotiation and implementation of treaties. Canada's constitution says the executive does all the work in treaties. It's not like South African constitution. Parliament has no right in Canada to approve treaties before ratification. But as a courtesy, as a matter of policy, good practice, the Canadian executive decided that every time a treaty is about to be ratified, it's been negotiated, the text is agreed, it will present a memorandum to Parliament. That memorandum will say the primary issues at stake, the obligations the countries will have, an analysis of the national interest, policy considerations, issues of division of responsibilities between the federal level and the provincial level, how the treaty would be implemented. Is there any part of the treaty the country is not going to accept, and why? Who has the executive consulted with? All of this will go into a memorandum. It will go to Parliament, and Parliament has 21 days to debate the treaty and to adopt a motion recommending what action the executive could take, including to recommend the treaty should be ratified or not. Now, what's important here is the quality of the parliamentary participation. Instead of the treaty simply being tabled and a simple motion accepting, finished, treaty is approved, there is debate. There is discussion by Parliament for 21 days before the executive goes ahead. Another example from Canada deals with trade treaties. We're all familiar that whenever the WTO meets, there are huge public protests, particularly in the north. People are not happy with the unfairness of the multilateral trading regime. Again, in Canada, some proposals were considered for improving the involvement of Parliament in the implementation, in the negotiation of trade treaties. And they came up with the following recommendation, that Parliament should deliver non-binding treaty negotiation mandates to the executive. Before the executive goes to a conference to negotiate the treaty, Parliament makes a non-binding statement. We recommend that South Africa's negotiating position should be this. That doesn't violate the Constitution, I don't think. It's not that the legislature is taking powers that it doesn't have. It's making a non-binding recommendation to the executive as the representative of the people. Other recommendations, that Parliament should monitor the negotiations by asking for reports from the negotiators or from other participants. That Parliament should communicate with the public and hear their concerns about the negotiations through, for example, public hearings. And that Parliament should exercise due diligence when passing implementing legislation. One of the challenges South Africa faces is that some of its implementing legislation for treaties is, well, with all due respect, is not very good implementing legislation. For example, the legislation implementing the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court simply annexes the whole Rome Statute, which is 127 articles, to an Act of Parliament and says this is binding in the Republic. There are many unanswered questions in that Act about who has the authority in the Republic to deal with certain requests from the court. It's not spelled out so clearly. So the quality of that implementing legislation could have been improved if members of Parliament had exercised greater oversight over what the content of that implementing legislation was going to be. I'd like to conclude my remarks by mentioning certain sound reasons of public policy which I think supports a greater role for Parliament in treaty making and implementation. The first I've already mentioned. International agreements are now so complex and so involved, and they touch every part of life in a way that they affect the lives of ordinary South Africans, business, small businesses, people who are detained in other countries or in this country. And that increased domestic impact engages the responsibility of the legislative authority, which Parliament. There is a need to preserve checks and balances. Parliament's role is to monitor the executive, and it can do so in the area of treaty negotiation as well. Also, we know that the way in which these treaty negotiations work and the way in which intergovernmental organizations work is not always transparent, fair, and accountable. The WTO is not a democratic institution. The United Nations is not a democratic institution. Some countries have vetoes, others are not members of this particular organ or can't get elected to that organ. In the absence of direct democratic accountability at the international level, Parliament can provide a measure of democratic accountability for how South Africa acts on the international plane. The paper by Mr. Ahmed begins by quoting Honorable Baleka Mbete, who made the following interesting comment. She says that the role of Parliament, I'm paraphrasing here, is to represent the interests of the people, the interests of the people at the domestic level and at the international level. And that's why I'd like to conclude. South Africans care not only about what happens in the borders of South Africa. They have something to say about their world. At the moment, there is no international parliament. The South African parliament is their voice in what their world should look like. Thank you for your time.
You know, as you were concluding, I was thinking of you have unraveled the mindset to what you were saying on this issue. And these members will tell you there's a particular tradition on how international relations was conducted in Parliament, which is very far from what you said. And also some of our ambitions or adventure on how we saw it. I think we must not discuss and not even ask questions. I want to recommend the following and see what the members are saying about it. That one thing that this presentation has unraveled a number of issues, it's going to force us as a committee to reflect deeply on this. It's going to force us review some of how we're doing our work. But first and foremost, it might be important that all our members benefit from this presentation. I might be calling for a repeat of this presentation. And I don't think it's just about all our members. If I have the power, I'll be saying all members of Parliament need to benefit. However, I don't have that power. But I suspect that we must find a way of inviting even our political office bearers in Parliament so that they can appreciate. They can appreciate what is involved here. Because it's not just about a seat here and there. Because there's a contestation about what is this thin line of division on the role of the executive and the role of Parliament? Heavily contested. But unless one understands exactly, so I'm requesting members that we organize a special workshop on this. Even if it's a weekend when we reopen, after coming from Zim, special workshop, where we must invite the office bearers just to be party to this. Where we have this presentation again, it will be an advantage to us who have been here, but all these others must get it if we want our work to continue. But also we'll have that presentation from the department in that particular workshop. Then we can raise all those issues. I think if we're to start engaging on questions now, the mindset, we can't start now. Honorable Mo.
Chair, I would agree with you more. I do support the fact that I think we need all members of the committee here. Because some of the things that you have pointed out here, we never learned during our induction as members of this committee. I open up some of us, but I also imagine that there are a lot of questions that we'd like to ask, clarification on some of these things that were mentioned here that we didn't have much understanding of. I agree with the chairperson that I think we need another presentation. We are going to engage at least at more, when we are more relaxed and when there's everybody here, so that we can get to understand what you have presented. But I think it was a very good presentation. It has taught me personally quite a lot of stuff that I didn't know. And I think your document, in spite of the fact that it's supposed to be a legal paper, it's very easy to understand. I am not a legal mind myself, but I can quite follow what you wrote in the document. And I will agree with the chapter that I think we need another presentation. Thank you very much.
Honorable Maha. The staff members are hereby instructed just to revise our program, speak to the presenter and see where we slot in July. We need a full workshop. That will be combined with the presentation of the Chief State Advisor on Internet. Full day, it's a Saturday, outside this parliament, we must find a way of inviting our principals, because they must appreciate this. As long as they do not appreciate this, it would be difficult to do our work. Agreed. Let me take this opportunity to thank this presenter. It was short and sweet, but has gone into the heart of our work when it comes to international agreement. The fact that Salim, we want you for some more. If somebody wants to say, I need some more, it means has enjoyed the first one. So we've enjoyed the first one, and we need the second one. And definitely this was an eye-opener for all of us. And, you know, remember that I nearly disrupted you or interrupted you when you were talking about accession. I remember debating accession in our committee. What it means if this thing already has already water under the bridge, and therefore, and so it was a big debate. And now it's starting to get clarified. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Honorable members, at this stage we will adjourn. And certainly, if all goes well, when we reopen, we will be on the way to see. But you would know that it can't be the full committee. If it's the full committee, you would have blown 80% of the budget. We're rationalizing it to 6, but we'll use the parliamentary formula, which is normally used on this particular trip. But we will be interacting with you during the holidays, telephonically, and otherwise they are busy with the logistics, provided we don't disturb somewhere at the center. Because we can do all the planning and then we're told, hey, because of the money and everything. And once more, my apologies on behalf of the whatever the section. When we're supposed to leave, there was a directive from the speaker's office that anything relating to 2010 preparation, nothing, because of the budget, which has been blown. I'm not sure whether some of the committees that dealing with agriculture might have gone to prepare 2010 to see to it that the fields are green, on a lighter note, of course. But the issue is that the budget, a lot had been spent, and then they had to ground everybody. We tried by all means to persuade them. Lastly, you notice that there's a new phrase, from the staff side, Baba Alwa, Changa, is the new secretary of this committee. Ule Alwa got some promotion in the committee section to coordinate a number of committees, because it came at a time when one of the senior managers was not there on a long duty. So she had to leave immediately. But fortunately, among the committees, she's helping to coordinate. International relations is also under those committees. Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.